Here we are on the last morning of our retreat together. We can reflect on how that feels. Whether it's a poignant feeling of not wanting to let go, or a yippee, finally gonna get out of here. I've been dying. But it's important to honor the ending of things, so that we don't too quickly just skip ahead to the next. This retreat is a perfect retreat. As our Dharma friends remind us, it's doing perfectly what all conditioned things do. It had a beginning. It grew up. Went through some aging and illness. A few minor strokes here and there. And now it's dissolving like a flower. Some of the petals dropping off. It's natural. We don't have to let out a big shriek of despair. Oh God, the petals are dropping off the flower. That's what happens. And there's seeds. Seeds that will be blown by the winds of karma, taking us wherever. Wherever our life, our destiny, our intentionality leads us. But there's an opportunity if we have intention, an opportunity for these seeds of whatever moments of recognition, moments of understanding, this is helpful, moments of touching into perhaps different dimensions of our being. Being able to kindly acknowledge the various moods and sensations, patterns, and even sense some of the ones that are more, as we've tasted, more unwholesome, that tangle us up. Being able to maybe have a moment of little more perspective on it, little more recognition of, rather than it's so much as me, as it's a pattern. It's a tendency. Oh, there you are. The seeds of accumulated power, which has happened here. Accumulated power of mindfulness, of moving to that Buddhic principle of awareness. Mindfulness of the way things are, the Dharma. That accumulated tendency to, when we're lost, to recognize that and return. That's called practice. If we have the wish, if there's an intention, then we can determine, I want this to take root, continue to take root, because many of you are already practitioners. Even if you might not call yourself Buddhist practitioners, there's a lot of beings here who, it's been wonderful to be with you all, who are committed to learning from life, growing, transforming, taking the opportunity to not just waste this life, but to use this mysterious gift of awareness, of energy, of presence. So as we savor, taste this ending, we can also consciously recognize, gather into the heart that we're moving, you know, back into our daily life, daily routines, to reflect on this possibility of planting or continuing to cultivate and nourish the seeds or the roots of our Dharma body, which flowers. Our Dharma body grows and flowers into wisdom and compassion. One of the most, well, perhaps the most important template, framework that the Buddha offered to guide us for our daily living was what he called the refuges and precepts. He called them eight great streams of blessings. We've mentioned this word before, a Buddhist word, punya, which sometimes is translated in English as merit, which I don't really like. The English word, it has so many associations of special gold stars or the one who gets the credit better than the others. Though that word isn't very good, what it's pointing to is energy, karma, creations, activities that have wholesome potentiality, wholesome energy. Here's the way the Buddha describes it. It was in the in Anguttara Nikaya, the text on the eights, because he's talking about eight streams. He's talking to the monks. He said, there are, O monks, eight streams of this word, punya, or merit. Then he defines it, streams of the wholesome, nourishments of happiness. That's an interesting word, that which feeds happiness. Nourishments of happiness that are heavenly, that ripen. So these sorts of streams ripen in happiness. Conducive to heaven, conducive to those states that are delightful, pleasing. That lead to whatever is wished for, loved, agreeable. That lead to one's welfare and happiness. So the Buddha is talking about this sort of energy, this sort of activity, this sort of karma, which he called punya, which lead to our welfare, to happiness. And the first three streams are when a disciple, when a seeker, like us, goes for refuge to the Buddha, goes for refuge to the Dharma, goes for refuge to the Sangha. The first three streams. This is a template for reflecting on our life, what is important to us, and it's a way of looking at deepening our intentionality to do something. Okay, it can just be a rite and a ritual, what we will offer at the 10:30 time, a way of going through the refuges, of doing that in a ceremonial way, for those who wish to participate. You can just listen if you wish. But more profoundly is that intention to look into, what do I trust In our daily life, we tend to go back into our tendencies, and our tendencies are guided by what we trust. We might trust getting our way and just be going back to just willful tendencies. We might trust distraction, just avoiding and getting by, or we each have a whole array of habits which we trust on some level. In our daily life, to really make a commitment to say, no, this is important. I want to more and more shift my center of gravity to Buddha, which we have been describing as moments of being awake. We reflected on the qualities of the Buddha every morning and being awake, being aware. And when we go home, guess what? Though it's all different. We'll be too busy, and as we've told the story many times, when people say they're too busy, Ajahn Chah, you know, says, too busy to breathe. But are we going to have our body with us? There's still going to be what's called nama-rupa, mind and body. Wherever we are in a moment, yes, we can get caught up in the place and what to say, what to do, but in a moment, can we remember? Where is my refuge in Buddha, being awake, just for a moment? Awareness. Just what we've been practicing, finding our posture. Finding the sensation. Buddha's aware of what? The Dharma. We're aware of the way things are. Buddha Dharma. The effort to keep returning to being awake when we realize we're lost. The effort to keep aligning ourselves with these skillful tools, these formal Dharma teachings that we've been practicing. Mindfulness and calming and investigating and letting go and kindness, all these Dharma techniques, tools. In a moment of being awake to the way things are, we can practice in a moment. This is a wonderful opportunity to be creative and find ways of allowing the seeds of what we've recognized in this permission we gave ourselves to retreat, to step back, to pause. And so it is useful this morning to reflect on some of what we sense is helpful for us. And then whether you use the refuge mechanism or not, use some mechanism where we determine, no, I want this to be more important in my life. This, however we describe it, this awareness, this honest connection with how things are, whether one calls it Buddha Dhamma Sangha. But these are universal principles that will guide us back to truth, awareness of how things are, and a persistence with that. Not just a moment, but to learn to sustain that, tune that. That's what Sangha is. That's what practicing, Supatipanno, Ujjupatipanno, Nyayapatipanno, Samichipatipanno. Learning little by little to be present and to open to even that which is difficult. To learn to find the middle between grasping and rejecting. Moments of tasting peace. First three streams are the refuge. The next five streams the Buddha called the great gifts. The great gifts. There are further amongst these five gifts. long-standing, traditional, ancient, unadulterated. In other words, they're pure. What are these gifts? A noble disciple gives up the destruction of life, abstains from it. In other words, we let go of that activity of killing. By doing this, by abstaining from the taking of life, the noble disciple, that's us. When we're on this line of awakening, we're on an ancient way of moving from suffering, confusion, a contracted state, imagining we are this and that, to walking that way of investigation, letting go, and returning home to the seamless, peaceful, return to the true nature. When we do this, this letting go of taking life, he said, we give to immeasurable beings freedom from fear, hostility, and oppression. And by giving to immeasurable beings freedom from fear, hostility, and oppression, the disciple gives himself or herself immeasurable freedom from fear, hostility, and oppression. For example, just the effort to not harm. That effort, when there's a commitment, this first precept is a training. I undertake the training. That's how, rather than a commandment, the Buddha said, no, this is a training we undertake voluntarily. That when we train ourselves to not harm, in a sense, we're training ourselves to cherish life, to be merciful where we can, to be compassionate, to recognize the connection with all that breathes, all that is. By doing that, it sounds negative, don't kill. Or I'm giving up killing. It sounds like a negative thing, but this is interesting. The Buddha said, actually, it's a great gift. Because if I am committed to the best of my ability to trying not to harm, on some level, everyone around me can breathe more easily. That's the aura that we give off. That when we do this, we are given to countless beings, immeasurable beings, freedom from fear, hostility, and oppression. And that eventually that karma of offering that to others lays a foundation. That's why it's called punya. That's why it's called an auspicious nourishment of happiness that leads to well-being, because that creation leads to the practitioner, ourselves, eventually experiencing immeasurable freedom from fear, hostility, and oppression. Each of the five precepts is called a great gift. So these eight streams of that which nourish happiness are the three refuges and the five precepts. All these precepts have a whole gradation. We keep deepening them. Second precept is about learning not to take what doesn't belong to us. In other words, giving up stealing. Third precept is about giving up sexual misconduct, using our sexuality to exploit another being, to take advantage, for example, of someone young. We use our power to take advantage of someone. That's exploiting. Or using our getting misguided by our desire, losing touch with wisdom, and being so interested in what I want that we don't realize consequences. So we might split up someone else's committed relationship, break up a marriage, or these are the areas that the Buddha identified as the wrong use of our sensuality. fourth precept is about speech, giving up, you know, false speech, telling lies. Fifth one is about giving up intoxication. Using liquors and drugs to distort the consciousness that the Buddha said leads to heedlessness, that are a basis for us not really being mindful and doing what we might later regret. But all these precepts, if we undertake that training, there's some level at which they're, we can use it. Like, you know, for a monk or a nun, you know, they try not even, some people might think we're crazy. You try not even to hurt an ant, and you spend you getting the ants outside and getting the flies out the window. And, you know, if you go in some places in, say, KwaZulu-Natal, when we showed up there, 18 people a day were being killed in political violence. If we just started talking about don't hurt the ants and that spider, please be very careful with the spider. You know, I mean, there was war going on. If one started at that level, but even just on the one level of can we try to give up, you know, just killing each other. Even just that, if everyone in the world, that was an intention. You know, we try not to do that. We're a very different place. And that training, why this is so is a foundation for daily life is in our actions. It might just be obvious. Oh gosh, come on. Who's gonna do this? Who's gonna do that? That didn't relate to us. If we regularly remember this as a stream of blessing, as something that the wise ones have said is a very important training, then it can be helpful. It's helpful in our situation when certain angry feelings come up, helpful just to pause. Same with the second precept in the monastic life. If you get it really refined, you won't even pick up someone else's pen, because maybe they, you know, don't want you fooling with their stuff. And that, you know, but that's, you know, very refined on one level. You know, can one just try not to rob banks? Or you know, on another level, noticing something in us that is imagining we're going to get happiness just by getting something, even though we're cutting a corner and it's not really proper. So on some level, one is trusting. No, the wise ones have said this foundation of happiness is learning not to really take what doesn't belong. And so at whatever level we can practice, it's useful, and it can get really refined until we're just really careful. Notice how this really makes us a present. We're just not so quickly grabbing things. We think, hey, is this meant for me? Or would they really not want me to go through their stuff? Oh, it doesn't really matter, but it might make us pause as we refine. Same with the third precept about sensuality and sexuality. Such a powerful area. So powerful. It's not a demonization of this energy, but as a foundation for wellness and happiness, the Buddha said it should be guarded, and that can be a gift. Our teachers described our energy is like a fire. And that the precept vehicle is like a fireplace. Fireplace? Stove, fireplace. That guides the fire. Is fire good or bad? Fire is what it is. But if it's not guided, it can just burn everything down. Hurt us, hurt others. But the fireplace allows us to enjoy the heat, to maybe for cooking or for enjoyment. But it guides the energy. The fire of our life is guided by our commitment, which doesn't come from the outside, comes from the inside, a training. Oh, may I use my thoughts and speech and actions in a way that doesn't harm or exploit. So when an emotion comes up and a tendency that maybe is getting us into a tricky area, it's like a red light flashes. It's warning us, ah, I'm getting into more of a tricky territory. And like with sensuality, this is very possible, because when we're attracted to our fellow beings, you know, it's a very beautiful, beautiful thing, and desire is very intoxicating, and sometimes we cannot be aware of how, what are the consequences here? And sometimes we get so caught up in what I want, what we're not aware of being sensitive to the other or to the context. Like, for example, if one is in a committed relationship, sometimes, you know, something seems so beautiful, sensual connection that is beautiful at the time. But then later, because of, you know, marriages and committed relationships, and there's devastation, people feel betrayed, and so these precepts help us pause. And there's all kinds of gray areas. They're not just black and white. It's not easy. Like our beloved dog in KwaZulu-Natal, you know, when he was being attacked by fleas, you know, fleas, they're very painful. You know, we got the medicine for him, flea power. Not because I'm saying, yippee, I want to kill fleas. I asked the fleas first. I said, I'm warning you, I'm going to put some medicine on. I suggest you check out and go somewhere else. I am not rejoicing in harming you, but I'm trying to protect Jack. Because without Jack, we're done. He's the heart of the monastery, the temple. If Jack goes down, and that would not be good karma for you guys. So I gave warning. But there are gray areas. It's not easy. So but they're guidelines. Each sounds negative, but it's giving up killing helps us cherish, be merciful and cherish life. Giving up taking what doesn't belong to us helps us be respectful of each other's property. The precept on sexuality helps us have loving relationships, respectful relationships, rather than sometimes when we get caught up in our passion, it's so what I want, and it's not sensitive to impact. Speech, whoa, in daily life, this is such a challenge. So quickly, the words just come out. But to remember this making the effort to give up falsehood. You know, if we want to be enlightened, want to be at one with the true nature of the universe, and in our own mind we're telling things that, so these people think this, those people think that, if we're doing things that are deceitful, that is not a karma that leads to the true nature. Then a real problem happens. People, when we get caught up into telling one thing to one and one thing to another, then guess what? We don't even know the truth. We get real good at denying, and we can even forget. And that is almost impossible to break through, because ignorance, when we're so good at denying things, so the practices that we've been doing of coming to the present moment and just noticing our intention. And yes, speech is difficult, because I used to think everything I said was a lie. I said this, but I didn't say that. And there was that feeling and that feeling. And it's impossible to say it all right, but to try. And as you know, so at first we might just try to give up. Okay, I'm keeping the fourth precept. I'll just try to give up telling big whopping lies. Little white ones I'm not going to worry about too much. And that's a good start. And then even in the Buddha even refined it, noticing when our speech is not only distortion, but sometimes it's speech that just divides people. Do you know what they did? They did that, and you won't believe. Ready? She said that. No! I'm sorry. There it is. Just thought you should know. And you know, it just splits. And it gets people on our side and against them. And just to notice that. Notice speech that is just harsh. It's just for hurting. Sometimes a strong speech is important because it's a warning. But sometimes it's just to hurt. And then, you know, they go away bleeding, so to speak. And we might get a flush of righteousness. They deserved it, didn't they? Yeah. We might have a flush of righteousness. But that karma is not conducive to well-being. Because guess what? Another one's coming back this way at some point, probably. Some speech is meaningless. And so in a way, learning to cultivate speech that's revealing, that's true, that helps unify, that touches the heart. Even sometimes there are things that are really need to be warned about, but sometimes if it's just done with the anger, it just thickens the wall between us. So sometimes developing the skill at speaking in a way that touches the heart, and trying to make our words mean something, rather than just be smoke screens of distraction, just totally meaningless. All these precepts, while they're so valuable for daily life, when we make a commitment, then when we're getting into difficult karmic territory, a little light goes off, so to speak, and warns us, oh, wait a minute. And it helps us be mindful, because we can't follow these precepts unless we're awake on some level. That's why they're the basis of the refuge. And the last one, you know, about intoxication. And you know, when we're in real pain, it's real, real tempting sometimes. One can just forget about it all. Get drunk or stoned. I remember a young Zulu man who was very honest. He got drunk a lot. I said, well, why do you do it? And then he would get in trouble, get in fights and all kind of trouble. But he gave me this really nice answer. He said, oh, I don't have to feel the pain. And it is a temporary escape from the pain, but there are consequences. He saw that. So he was making the intention. He was trying to reduce it. He just knew it. Short term, feeling better. Long term, my God, I said that. I did that. In my youth, I was schizophrenic. I would get so stressed and I would just drink and then I wouldn't be inhibited. This is freedom. I wouldn't be the word inhibited? Inhibited means you're scared to do something because you're worried about what people think. But when I was drunk, I didn't care. And so I was free. And then the next day I found out my friend was mad at me. I said, why are you mad at me? And he said, you drove my Jeep into the lake. I drove his car into the lake and thought it was funny. At the time, it was funny. That's called wrong seeing. Distortion. And sometimes the Buddha identified that sometimes these intoxicants distort our mindfulness. So he didn't call them evil. He just said one lets that go. Now again, as a beginning, one can, you know, make the, to train, one can say, well, I'll just try not to get really drunk. But that can also be refined. You know, for myself, I have addictive tendencies. You know, as a youth, as I was saying, that's how I dealt with stress. But once I was a monk at 24 and I saw these tendencies, Ajahn Chah said using drink and drugs like that, he said it's like sending a gorilla up a tree for coconuts. At first it seems really good deal. Don't have to do the work. You go get them. Then he might start throwing them down at you. Or he said it's like going on a spending spree with your credit card. And you know, you got this piece of plastic. You're riding high. Just give them the plastic and you get what you want. But when your bank account goes dry, Ajahn Chah would say, "Siya parami." It uses up, it spoils your storehouse of this good energy. He didn't say it was evil. He just said that's what happened. And if you get used to every time you don't feel so good, you just... I used to have a motto. This is when I was younger. After I was 24, then I realized I just gave it all up. For me, it's really helpful to give up drinking, drugs, all that. But before, if I got really stressed out, my motto was drop back and punt. I would just lift off, go above it, get intoxicated, or get stoned or something. And then your storehouse of patience, your ability to be with life, gets smaller. So when as long as the credit card's still working, sometimes we can get away with it, but at a certain point we hit something like an illness, a circumstance, and then our ability to just bear with is so thin, then we're devastated. All of these trainings have a way in which we can enter them. And the Buddha said is a template for our daily living. They're very important. Same with the refuges. As we go home, and as in this next walking period, we have some time to reflect on our life at home. Still be here in the body, but allow the image of home, our work, and just to reflect some on these principles of committing ourselves to trusting awareness and finding moments of coming back. At home, at the office, walking to a moment of how is it now? That moment of trusting Buddha, refuge, awareness of what? Of Dharma, of the how it is. And to be able to notice if we're the tendency, if we're in such a hurry as we get home, we're in such a hurry to get to the next thing because of all our duties. And in a moment we can just say, oh, it's like this. And feel that hurry. And practice a moment of patience. And even a moment of kindness, rather than thinking, oh gosh, I've lost it all, had it, and then it's gone. A moment of kindliness, of just, feeling this being that's in a hurry. I used to, at the end of every retreat for quite a while, even in the monastery, feel a bit depressed. And what I realized I love the feeling relatively of presence and of the smoothness of our nervous system. And I just wished it would just stay. And then someone would look at me a little funny and then I'd start worrying. And sometimes that's just the natural loss of samadhi. The conditions here are helping us be more composed. And it's natural that that level of composure will disperse. So I encourage us to be really, really patient. And not to undervalue even a moment of noticing. Remember what the Buddha said, even a moment of noticing change is valuable. But we could think, oh gosh, at the retreat it was like this and now it's all gone. That's an important moment. Oh, now it's all gone. Oh gosh, I'll never get it back. What am I going to do? To have a moment of noticing, ah, listen to this. Be kind. Notice that tendency. Wherever you are, whether you're standing, at home, driving, we can always turn to the refuge, awareness of how it is. And it's the formal practices that we've offered. You know, it is useful to reflect, as many of you already have a regular practice, some don't, but to reflect on how can I determine a commitment to some pausing, some sitting. And rather than saying, yes, hour and a half morning, hour and a half evening, once a week, I'm going to do an all-night sitting, like Kitty Sorrow. And that's great if one can do it, but be careful about getting so excited and then lasting, you know, 4.5 days. And then, you know, one collapses, oh gosh, well, I'll wait for the next retreat. But to be modest, even 10 minutes, 15 minutes in the morning. And even if it's not as calm as you were here, don't think it's wasted. Even 10 minutes of just practicing noticing the body, noticing the mood. That's perspective. That's useful. You can't even a little time at night before you go to bed. Oh, no, if I don't get enough rest, then I won't be able to do the work. And then you know what happened when I got that tired last year. Even 5 minutes of hearing yourself panic if you don't get enough rest. Even 5 or 10 minutes where you just sit there and hear the panic and bless the panic. Buddha is Bhagava. It blesses. Our awareness, when it touches something, blesses it. It already becomes different. Even 5, 10 minutes hearing yourself panicking about not getting enough rest, you'll hear its movement, and for a moment you'll get more the sense of it being a habit, a tendency, rather than me. Be creative. All these different tools, you might want to try this, try that. Different tools. A chant. A walk. A meeting from time to time with a Dharma friend. There's all sorts of ways. There isn't a rule book how to do it. But this is, as we like to say, the advanced course. This is the PhD of practice. Is that challenge of little by little gathering it at home. And, so at the, we're going to have a walking period just to be with yourself and allow it, the mind to be a little more wide, images of home, reflecting some on the retreat, what's useful. And then when we come back at 10:30, we are going to do in a traditional way, offer this ancient way of going for refuge, making a commitment to, in whatever way it means to us, to Buddha, awareness, Dharma, the way it is, Sangha, practice, and these 5 precepts. And so if you wish, and to adjust what level, to just trust your adjusting yourself, what it means for you. And if one doesn't feel comfortable, that's all right too. You're welcome to just listen to the sounds. So we'll have that as the first part when we come back from our walking period, and then Tanisra will guide us in a closing way as we come little by little come out of our silence and into speaking.